Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. And our guest today is Enor Bishop. Enor is a writer and comedian originally from Cincinnati, Ohio. They are currently based in Los Angeles, where they produce a monthly comedy show, Boys Night Out, and recently taped their first stand-up half hour at the Lyric Hyperion. Enor is performing his solo show, Transcribe, a story about subtitles for the Elysian Theater's Spaghetti Festival, November 15th. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh my gosh, I am so excited to talk about this book from 1987 by Stephen King, Misery. Oh my goodness. For those who don't know, the story is a author gets held hostage by his number one fan. It is absolutely delicious. What is your story with this novel? How did it come into your life?
So I know that you had posted, like, has anyone read a Stephen King book at like a young age? And I responded on Instagram. I found this book literally in a very spooky kind of Stephen King-esque way, like in my grandma's house in like the back of her bookshelf, sort of like it was hidden potentially. I spent a lot of time from Cincinnati. My mom's from Kentucky, just right across the river. In Maysville, Kentucky,
Oh my
small town.
gosh. My mom is from Paducah, Kentucky.
Oh my God, that's crazy. I don't know
Oh
where
my
that
gosh.
is in relation, but yeah, Maysville, famously home of George Clooney. That's sort of that's the big news there. Yeah, I could tell you about Cincinnati and Kentucky celebrities forever. But yeah, my grandma is a very good Christian woman. She does not, drink, literally never heard her like use profanity very. So it was kind of surprising in general that she even had this. A lot of the other books on the bookshelf, I was thinking about this kind of in relation to the podcast theme, like a lot of like generations past children's literature, like some real antique, like Nancy Drew's, but the Bobbsey twins, but it's the Hardy Boys, but even more, more twins. Are the Hardy Boys twins? I know that
I don't
they're
know.
boys.
Yeah, what else do you need?
But yeah, so I found this kind of hidden. I don't know if she had read it and decided it was not good in a way that seems kind of Annie Wilkes-ian to kind of
Yes.
hide it in the back. But I was aware of Stephen King, and I was aware of Misery specifically. It come up in conversation. Maybe I've heard about the movie, but I knew that this was sort of a good circumstance for me because I was very fascinated by the concept of this book. Probably would have been embarrassed to like be seen like checking it out for the library. Like I felt because I was so fascinated with specifically this like kind of idea of like a parasocial fanatical relationship. Like it was kind of a book that I read, maybe not necessarily in secret, but I wasn't like very much like I was reading it at night, like putting it under my bed. I remember I talked to my sister recently about this actually, because I was saying I was doing this podcast, and she was like, oh, she's 2 years older than me. We, had the same kind of childhood at my grandma's place, and was like, I had no idea you even read that book or that it was even there. And I was like, oh yeah. So I didn't even remember like not telling her about it, but it was very much something that I was like, oh, this is I don't know if I'm supposed to be reading this vibes. So I don't think I had read a lot of like more adult fiction at that time. I think I was probably like 12 or 13. But yeah, I was fascinated, and I think that it was a really good book to kind of start on in like a Stephen King way because it's so much about writing. And I was, and still am, but at the time very much like a aspiring writer. So this like story about writing was so like I think that's. I know people often recommend Stephen King's book about writing. I haven't read that book specifically, but I feel like you can glean some of the best like writing advice I've ever read from Misery, because it's like, oh, how does the mind work in these like desperate circumstances? But I think one of the funniest aspects of the book, like it's not funny when you're reading it, but when you step back from it, it's just like the idea that, and I feel like I could relate to it very deeply, where it's like Paul, the writer, gets so caught up in finishing the story that it even takes over his idea of escaping in some ways. And that is just like so, I think, relatable to like the idea of like being an artist and feeling like you're finally in a productive rhythm is like more important than almost anything else in the world.
Yeah. Annie Wilkes, who is the fan and the hostage holder, reads Paul's most recent book in this series about this adventurer romance figure named Misery. And she does not like the ending of the final book and tells him, you have to write a new one. And it becomes clear that when the book is finished, Paul will probably be murdered. And yeah, there was even a moment where I was like, he's, obviously trapped. He has no contact with the outside world. And he's talking about how productive he gets. And I was like, oh, should I do this to be productive? And I was like, hold on, what are we doing here?
Yeah, like quarantine mode.
Yes. And he talks about, like, I used to write a page a day, and now here I am writing 12, 13, but I loved that. I had seen the movie when I was maybe 15, and I think I fell asleep during it. So very, very, but of course Kathy Bates
Yeah.
is undeniable, and that stuck in my memory.
It's hard to picture anyone other than Kathy Bates, even when reading the book, I
Yeah.
think. But also, I think reading this book before I watched the movie, it was like probably one of the first times I had read about like an older woman being terrifying and also powerful. Like the way that he describes her as like this godlike figure, like this ancient, almost like pagan figure of like, I was thinking a lot about how this is so like a man's idea of like the terrifyingness of like terrifying and unknowingness of femininity, where it's just like this woman who like he does not understand her. She has these violent mood swings. Like she is evil, but in a way that is so unknowable to him, to the main character, and I think to Stephen King. It's like I've never read a villain like this before.
Yes.
And I think something that also really drew me to this book before I'd even read it at all was like this idea of kind of a role reversal of like there are so few, and I think, growing up with like a lot of children's media, like, Disney stories and stuff, there are so few times when like the roles are reversed and you have this like man in distress instead of like a damsel in distress. I remember like the first time I saw, this might seem like a strange parallel, but first
No.
time I saw Han Solo, like in Star Wars, when he was like frozen into
Yeah.
carbonite, and like they go and rescue him. That was like crazy to my brain, where I was like, wait, like this man is like being helpless and like he's being saved by,
Yeah.
Princess Leia, by like this, the woman. Like, I think just the idea that it is just like this powerful man who's like a writer, he's famous. And he is now like the weak one. He is at the mercy of this person who is very much, I think, would be looked down on. He wouldn't give her a second glance or step
Yeah.
to be like, oh, one of the crazy. I think he even talks about like other women like her who are like these crazy fans that he just, kind of brushes off, doesn't really think much of. And like, I think it is so interesting the way that people who are perceived to not be a threat to society, like who are perceived as powerless or just like not even power, like she has all these roles of power, but they're in this like soft power, maternal, quote unquote maternal, like realms, like being a nurse, like the way that that is a place for like huge misuse of power because it's seemed to not be there at all is just like, I love just like the character of Annie as
Oh my gosh, yeah.
just a woman who is evil and in or think that I think is rare, especially in like, was this the 80s, the
Yeah, this
70s?
was 87.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
it's like, I'm not saying like Stephen King is a great feminist hero. He's definitely not. And like, I think that the terror of her is like because he has these preconceived ideas about women. But yeah, I love how evil she is and how terrifying and how, she doesn't fit these ideas of what women are and what I grew up thinking that women had to be.
Yeah, Annie Wilkes is one of the most incredible characters I've ever encountered. There are these images that are so strong in the novel. There's this axe that comes in and plays a big role. Even though reading it, that was not the most startling image to me. Annie is incredible and stands out in a way that she will always be with you, sort of no matter where you go. And there's so much to dive into here, but I really loved, and how you said it, of how Stephen King is able to look at this fanatical relationship that, I mean, at this point he'd been writing for, I think, or publishing for, I think, 13 years. I know this is his 21st novel.
So crazy.
Insane. And so he had, I did some research on it. He said that this novel is a response to, he publishes like a fantasy novel a couple years ahead. And people say, no, you're a horror writer. We want you to do horror. But I think at the same time, he has this gunslinger series that is this, huge character who goes on again and again and again. And so I thought there has to be some kind of interplay there. But this was my first Stephen King novel. And immediately I was like, I need more. I was sad when this book ended. I immediately started reading The Shining, which I'm still
Finding
reading.
next, that's probably the second Stephen King book that I read as well. Next.
And you said that have you seen the movie? You hadn't seen the movie when you first read it.
No, I think I saw the movie a few years ago for the first time. I did a double feature on a plane. I watched Phantom Thread and then Misery.
Oh my
And I think that
God.
there's an interesting thing there about like power dynamics and like power coming from unexpected places. Definitely interesting double feature if you're looking for
That is the most brilliant double feature. I
it.
am a huge fan of Phantom Thread, and there's, I'm thinking about a line near the end where one of them says to the other, is like, nurse me back to health, and
It's like what if Misery was consensual? That's
Exactly. It's misery, but everyone's in on it. Everyone's a little turned on by it. Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. You hadn't read any Stephen King before this, right? This was your
No,
first.
yeah, I was very much, I think I had maybe seen The Shining at like a sleepover. I didn't grow up in like a horror movie family. Like I was very much probably the opposite of that. Grew up Christian, pretty sheltered. Wasn't really allowed to watch like R-rated movies till I got older, kind of thing. A lot of control over the media I was consuming. So, and I was also just like prone to nightmares and like had an overreactive imagination. So I would generally like I remember getting terrified by like the trailers for horror movies at like Blockbuster throwback. Going to Blockbuster physically. But like, yeah, like a trailer for The Happening and my Shyamalan's, like, I remember just like seeing that and like being terrified for weeks. Just like, so very much like I kind of would stay away from like scary things. But I would always like, I was always fascinated. Like I always wanted to know. So I would like read a lot of like movie plots on like Wikipedia and stuff. I would look them up because I was like, I need to know the twist. I need to know. But I would never like watch the movies because I was scared of them. But like definitely like I would read a lot. I would be like, okay, Stephen King, what is this guy like? And definitely look up a lot of plots of his books and movies to just like because I needed to know.
Oh, I love that. I love, first off, you said very overactive imagination, and that it's something that our protagonist says explicitly about himself as a child, which I love. And this was sort of almost secretive for you because so much of this novel is Paul hiding things under his bed, of collecting secrets, of Annie can't know what I'm doing and all of his ways to engineer and escape. And he does escape in the end, but minus a foot and minus a thumb, and of course, drastically changed. It's so good. It's so good.
Truly. And I love that this is like I wouldn't say I know like the whole oeuvre. I don't think I'm using that word right. But like, I would say for a Stephen King novel, I think it is exceptional that it is not like so tied to this like supernatural. Like, it is very like pretty much everything that happens in the book, it's taking place in like our world. Like, he has these visions and like these imaginations of her, but it's very clearly like that is his brain, which I think makes it even scarier because it is this, you can't be like, oh, well, I don't live in the world with ghosts or whatever. I think a scene that was like, I have a distinct memory of like reading it at night and needing to stop and put the book under my bed because I was like, this is too scary. I can't read this right now. Was when he has this vision, and I'm forgetting if it is a real thing or if this is just part of his like fevered brain, but where she's bringing out a birthday cake and his severed thumb is like on the cake, and it's like the stream of consciousness. Like I think there's like the lyrics to like girls just want to have fun or like play. I think like this thing that was so like I think that it is hard, especially now in this like digital age. Like I think sometimes people are like, how can a book be scary? But it's like if you were seeing these images and like the way that he even changes, you know, the sentence structure to feel this like terrifying experience, like it was so visceral. And I like don't think I'll ever forget just like that image.
No, that I was saying, like, everyone, when they even the ebook that I had, the image people pull away from this and definitely from the movie is Kathy Bates with an axe. She cuts off his foot. And there's a great image also with that of she's like leaving the room and holding the foot and the toes are still moving. That was incredible. But yeah, like you said, the image that I came out of this absolutely stuck on is the severed thumb as a birthday candle. And I think it might actually have happened. I think it might not have been a fever dream, but I also loved what you said about like the writing is sort of stream of consciousness of the, like it's not first person. It is all third person, and yet you are so extremely in Paul's head that he'll, you know, stop a sentence halfway through and cut into italics or parentheticals to be a thought that he's having or be a memory that he's having or a lyric from Girls Just Want to Have Fun. So there are these like mental interjections, and yet it is so fast and absolutely, it is rare to have a book that is a literal page turner, and this 100% was one. This is like, I would hate to have to put it down and have to do something else and come back to it. It's thrilling, does not even begin to describe it.
The thing that, and I'm trying to look up the exact term that he uses about like falling into the page, like finding the hole in
Yeah, the
the
hole in the
room.
paper
Yeah,
opens.
I think about that still like creatively is like I said, like some of the best advice on writing that I've ever read. In like it also we're talking about like how relatable it is and how Stephen King has written so many books. And I think that I find that reassuring in a way that like even though he's known as like being this crazy productive author, like this book is so deeply relatable about how hard it is to write things. And I think I know a lot the kind of the other part of this book that I didn't relate to as a child, but like it's definitely very personal for him about like addiction. And he talks about how he's so productive in this situation because it's also like, you know, he's addicted to pain pills the whole time, but like he's not smoking, he's not drinking, and like he has it's like it is in a way, you know, as much as it's a horror, it's also like this fantasy of having these decisions being made for you, like having these things be out of your control, and like the idea that you could create great art if only like you were out of the way.
100%.
Like you were saying, like I think reading that every time when I read, especially like that end part where he's like on this really productive, he's grinding, he's getting into this flow. Like I always do come after that, being like I gotta have more discipline in my life. I gotta
I
get
gotta
this
grind.
done. Yeah, I gotta do the Paul Sheldon, you know, 90-day writing challenge. I don't remember how long he's there for, but
I think he might be there for at least like 9 months. It's the spring when the first cop comes around, and that's a fantastic scene. Annie runs over the first police officer with a lawnmower. There's so much to discuss there that this novel comes out in 1987. King is actively struggling with addiction, and at the end of that year, I think this comes out in June, in November, his wife stages an intervention. He goes into treatment. I mean, he starts, I think Carrie comes out in 74, and he says, like, I do not remember the 80s. He wrote Cujo, and he's like, which came out 81. He's like, I have absolutely no memory of writing Cujo. And like, I knew he struggled with addiction. I knew The Shining is about alcoholism. I didn't know this until I was, almost done with the book and researching that he was in the midst of addiction while writing it. He has such clarity on addiction as a whole. And yet, to me, I was reading it and I was like, this has to be a degree of clarity that comes when you are sober, and it's not. And that is mind-blowing to me.
No, that is fascinating. Like, I think a lot about like how hard it is to make art about like the specific stage of life you are currently in. And that's fascinating. Like, I think that again just makes it feel even more like a fantasy of like this idea that like what if there was this power beyond yourself that could stop you from even doing these self-destructive things, but also like, that is also a malicious entity's like kind of the struggle of like being of like self-actualizing of being like, no, I can't stay in this like maybe it is sort of like the idea of like being in like a rehab facility where things are taken away from you and the idea of being like, okay, well, I have to get out of here and live my own life and what does that look like is very interesting.
Yeah, there's I mean, you were talking about the supernatural elements, and I think that's in so much of King's work. And the exceptional thing about this is that everything in this could happen. Absolutely none of this is impossible. And I think that's like the most effective. I think horror is not always, but often the things that are the most real. I think what's also interesting is that he lived almost all of his life in Maine. He has a brief interlude where he actually lives in Boulder, Colorado, which is right outside where this takes place. And all of his stories are interconnected. There's, this fictional town of Castle Rock where most of his novels take place. But the Misery, or excuse me, Misery and the Shining are outside. And yet there is one line in Misery where she's like, oh, there's this hotel where a guy went crazy, which I loved. It's so satisfying, those moments. But I love what you've said about some of the greatest like writing advice comes through this. I have his book on writing that I'm so excited to read one day, just haven't touched.
Actually, same. I have that. I think I
Yes.
read one chapter for a class one time, and I'll get back to
Yeah.
it.
But I think in one of my most recent episodes about Frankenstein, I talked with my guest about there are movies for movie people and then movies for everyone. And I think a big part of Paul's reckoning in this is that Annie may not be a writer, but she is the perfect audience member, and she keeps him honest as a writer. He writes the first chapter of this book that is the story within the story, and we get lots of chapters from, which I loved.
That's like an ultimate favorite thing in fiction for me when there's like a story within the story. I'm like, I'm there. I'm reading. When I see like the page that's like we're in the story within the story, I'm always like, I got it. I gotta
I
get it. It's
know.
something about like knowing you're not gonna get the whole thing. It's like seeing only glimpses. I love it. I'm always obsessed with it.
Yes, I was not only so enthralled by the story, but also I wanted to know what happened to Misery. And Misery is the protagonist's name within that. But he writes this first chapter, and she says, like, no, this doesn't make sense. Like, you're contradicting facts that happened in the last book. And there's talks about, like, I can't think of the exact words right now of what could happen, and do you believe what could happen? And being in summer camp and proposing stories, and I think that's really good writing
The idea
advice.
of establishing rules and having to work within the rules you have established. And I do, I think this is the kind of book that I think only someone like Stephen King, who has already at this point had a long career being a successful writer, can write about this sort of like, I think a lot of times creative people, when they achieve success with something, they can grow a resentment for it or for the people that like it, especially if they feel like it's, somehow beneath them, like they have like some better. And I think that Paul's like journey with this of realizing like he starts out and he's like, I've finished. And that's another thing that absolutely always gets me is like the scene where he burns his novel that he is like, this is my new novel, this is gonna change things, and it's completed the way that it just like the idea that it's completed and it's gone forever. And that's so like a pre-internet. I mean, I think they even talk in the book where he's kind of old-fashioned for not having copies, But it's just like so, I think about it all the time, like, oh, it's gone forever. But
Yes.
like this idea that he's over Misery, he's over those series, they're beneath him. And I think a part of it that I think doesn't always get, I don't think it's super talked about in the book, but I think it's a theme of like him being like, these are romance novels for women. They're like, he resents his audience. And then he comes through this basically like an ego death, which is, you know, paired with his almost near death. So it's like,
Yeah.
you know, but like where he comes to be like, no, Misery is the best thing I've ever done. It's probably the best I can do. And like this new book, like he not only writes it like once. Yeah, once Annie is like, your first attempt, she calls him out on it. She says it was bad. You thought that I'm an idiot who's just going to eat up anything you do. And that's the whole thing with Misery as well, is like, or not Misery, but Annie, is that like he constantly underestimates her, even though she's shown to have this immense power over him. Like every time he moves around the apartment or the house and like doesn't think that she'll notice, and like turns out she knew the whole time, was just waiting for him to basically hang himself. Like, and it's just like, yeah, he comes to realize that like through this process he writes what he thinks is like his best work ever, and it is Misery, and it is this story that he's been resenting because he has this idea that there's like a better piece of art out there probably that would give him mainstream respect from like his author friends and like men, I think is a big thing. I don't know why I'm thinking about like Matt Rife right now, like in saying that, where it's like this idea that, you know, Matt Rife, like, and it's like, what even happened to him? He's whatever. But like, you know, he had this big fan base of like largely women fans and like actively resented them to the point of like drawing most of them away, I would say, because he wanted this like respect from his like peers. And I think it's just like the way that, yeah, the way that like men especially will like resent their own audiences if it doesn't represent what they think that they're like worth is so interesting to me.
I hadn't thought about it really in these terms, but he Misery's below him. It's not art. He goes to, at the beginning of the novel, goes to like a writer's retreat or like a self-imposed writer's retreat and finishes his art novel, his great novel.
Fast
And
Cars.
yes,
This is such a
Fast
funny title
Cars.
too. And I think Stephen King is intentional about that by being like, this is pretentious.
It's also like, now that I'm thinking about it, it is the epitome of masculinity. It's about a hard kid in the streets who loves cars and knives. And yet he comes to this point of like, no, Misery is good and it is commercially successful and that there is art in these books. I think there's almost a degree of like underselling himself or something, but like to make these novels addictive and to make a fan like Annie, it has to be in some way good and compelling. And he is at the beginning of this of the novel, Misery's Child, which is supposed to be the last Misery book, is published and he's on to the next one. He's, so excited to be gone. And yet when he is writing Misery's Return, he is sad to see her go. And like you said, the story within the story, Misery's Child ends with Misery dying. And that's what Annie is so upset about. And the whole time I am like, how is he gonna untie this knot? How is he gonna bring Misery back? You're so invested, and it is like a writerly thing. How are you gonna untie this knot?
Within the and I love, because she mentions watching these like cliffhanger soap opera basically at the movie theater that she would go to, and how they would often basically cheat by like ending things on a cliffhanger and then starting the next week, basically like pretending like that didn't happen for the ease of the story. And I found that so relatable, of like she was talking about being a child watching these movies and being so mad that they didn't follow the rules they established. And like that's so like, I think I've always loved storytelling as like a framework, as like this puzzle box. Like I used to always love, like specifically like going to see like Pixar films because they were so intricately planned, and like you could always trust that like everything that was set up would be paid off. And I think that I've always been like that person, like after a movie, that like can't stop talking about my criticisms of it, like from a story structure that can be kind of a buzzkill at the end of like a movie. And I think I'm usually right, like I will stand by it, but it's also like, yeah, people don't always want to hear that, like when they're just seen a movie that they like, but I'm like, but that thing didn't make sense, and this thing, and it's like never from like a, I used to watch, CinemaSins, like YouTube is a thing that you'd watch. And like, that's so like a nitpicky, like being like, there's a plot hole here, blah, blah, blah. But like, I always see it as a thing of like, it actually excites me to talk about things that I don't like for, about a movie or story from like a structural perspective, because I'm always like, okay, well, what would I do? How would I change it? And like, I love that. Like, I never see that as like a criticism for no reason. Like, I am like always trying to like think about how I would change a story to be more effective and to follow the rules that the story itself has established. Like, I think that's, yeah, I think that's like such a storyteller brain thing. And I think it is interesting how Misery or how Annie is always like, she's like, well, I'm not a writer. And I think that, and Paul talks about how he's like, she isn't interested in like, I'll try to tell her about craft. Like he will talk about things and be like, I think he talks about having like, like writing students that were like, that would be like drooling for these like tidbits about his craft and his routine, but she's so uninterested in the process. She just wants the result. But I think like you're saying, that is like, she is like the perfect audience member in that way of like, she is just ready to consume what he's putting out, as long as it is in good faith, essentially, if it's following the same rules. And we talked about parasocial stuff, but I think that's another thing that at the time, I think you have to be someone like Stephen King. You had to be like a huge star to receive that kind of like crazy fan thing. And like now, and especially like, when I was growing up, like when I was reading this book, I really related to it from like the level of being a kid and like having these, obsessive, growing up like, in like the 2010s, and like that was like this huge burst of like fandom culture. And like that would sometimes, sometimes it was just based on, franchises and characters. Sometimes it was around, real people, like the Directioners, the Believers. It was always like these were real people that we were all like so invested in, and like writing fanfic about, like, and it's just all these things where it's like, and I think it's like that way of how horror could explore things that people are ashamed, or like things that are hard to understand. But like the relatability of like being like, no, like I do wish I had some kind of, I have this feeling that like if I just met this person, we would be great friends. And it's like, well, how could I force that to happen? And it's like this fantasy. And it honestly reads like a fanfic at the beginning, in this like real like self-insert fanfic where it's like, I was driving along in my little town, nothing ever happens, and a car crash. But is that my favorite author in the car? Like that sounds like a, like they sold me to One Direction fanfic, like where it's like this idea of like happenstance bringing people together. Like I remember working like my first summer job in Ohio, and just like, daydreaming like to pass the time, and being like, what if like my favorite YouTuber just happened to come into, the snack stand at the pool that I was working at? But it's like, and it's so crazy, like moving to LA and then being like, oh, that actually happens here, where it's like you can just be like working at your day job and a celebrity comes in, and it's like, no, like that's not like a meet cute, but like, and you do, I think that was a big thing of like moving to LA where celebrities and famous people actually are, and being like, oh, like I actually do have to check that like thing in my brain that thinks that I know someone just because I've like followed them on Instagram for a long time. And it's like, I do think that is something that you have to like, if you're in the entertainment industry or like a performer in some way, of being like, no, like I have to like put that fan thing, I have to understand it and like put it away, because otherwise like I will never be able to interact with people on like a human to human level.
Especially it when you are in the entertainment industry and you have been a fan, you do have to find yourself like if you get to meet your heroes or what or any like even just be in the same, CVS as your heroes, you do have to stop and be like, "Oh, they're a person having a day, like just like me." I've had moments where I like, work with people I really respect and I get in my head, I'm like, "They don't like me, whatever this and that." I'm like, "Actually, they're tired. Actually, they're just a shy person." And that's and Annie doesn't kind of want that. And
No.
I don't
And
know, it's
I was just thinking how it's like, I think this is often the case with like people who are like maybe deeply insecure, or just like create their own problems in a way, where if she had taken him to the hospital, if she had found him and taken him to the hospital, he would be indebted to her forever. Like, she actually could have this kind of like deeply res like based in respect, like relationship with this man that she is obsessed with. But like, that's not ever in her mind. And of course, like, she's already at this point a serial killer. Like, it's not like she's, so that isn't how she would think about things. But it is this thing of like, I think often when people are like deeply insecure and like they have this idea of like, everyone hates me, and then they like act in a way that is like antisocial, it's like the self-fulfilling prophecy of like, well, yeah, now, of course, he's never going to be your friend. But like, if you just started with an assumption that like the world is maybe like, or just like kind of a rational understanding of the world, then it's like, yeah, like you could have actually been like literally a lifeline. Like, he probably would have thanked you in the acknowledgments of his next book or something, but that wouldn't have been enough for her, of course. Like, that's not what she's interested in.
Well, and even then, I'm sort of like, would he have respected her? Or would have he just been like, yeah, a fan is acting like a fan, you know, she loves me, and sort of written it off, and he like, you know, he had to learn those lessons in order to, he had to realize that fast car is not gonna be, you know, the thing that he is remembered for.
Won't be your big book.
No, and I knew of Stephen King as this like hyper-productive writer and so revered, and I think I had this in my head of like, he can't be that good. And he is.
No, like he, and it's, I, you know, and I've read a small handful. I think I've read Shining, this, Carrie, and then I've seen like other movies of stuff, but like, it's like, I know that there are definite like misses in his work, but like, no, like he is like, it's really phenomenal, like the way that he communicates and like paints a picture. And it is, I think it's like, I don't know, I'm always interested in like, I think that usually people that go, like either filmmakers or writers that go to these very dark places, I think they're often very kind of like quiet, soft-spoken people. And I think it is a lot about just like delving into these, like acknowledging the shadow parts of not being like, oh, I can never imagine something so sick and twisted because that would mean I'm bad. It's like, no, like he's using his imagination, like this overreactive imagination, it seems like he probably has had his whole life, to be like, well, let me fully interrogate these feelings and like, what would it look like to like let this one facet of my personality like become this monster of like, there's so much truth to it. I mean, I know that there have been cases of these like angel of death nurses, like that is, and so it's, yeah, it's not, it's based in a reality of like a type of person, and it's not the serial killer that we're used to hearing about.
That's interesting. I mean, it's 87, and I don't have all the dates, you know, right in front of me, but we do think of a serial killer as Ted Bundy, you know, and that was very much in the zeitgeist at the time. And yet it's Annie Wilkes. It is this, you know, this woman that no one would expect. And I think that, you know, I did some research into Stephen King. He starts writing when he's 6 or 7. This is my favorite detail. So his dad leaves when he's 2 years old, so he spends all of his time with his mother's family and starts writing at 6 or 7. And his aunt Gert, Gert, would give him, I think, a quarter for every story he wrote. And I feel like that has to be an element of his prolific nature, of like, there's a reward coming if I do this. I read that he starts with a situation instead of a character, and the characters come later. And I think I've seen, and that's why like the log lines are so perfect. Like it's, you know, writer held hostage by fan. It's so succinct. The conflict is there. And I think I'd seen some people say like the characters are flat in a lot of King's work. And if they don't come first, fine. But these are some of the richest characters, the most interesting dynamics, the most wonderful escalations. I was reading it and be like, how am I only 25% of the way through this book? How is there more to come? And it is so quick moving and yet so microscopic in the moments, in the details, in the escalation. It is so granular and yet never dull. You are never like, come on, let's move it along. It is, yeah, it's gripping. It's thrilling. It's an incredible piece of writing.
No, and I think it is like a testament to like how great works come from like, even if it's self-imposed limitations of being like, This story is taking place in a cabin or like in one house, basically two characters the whole book. And like I know it's been adapted to like a play. I think like two times it's been adapted to like a stage play, which makes sense. Like I think that it's like this is a character piece essentially. Like this is like a character study of two people. And yeah, it's like there's so much richness there. And like talking about like the first time a police officer comes and you're like, well, there's no like how she's done for. Like, what is, and it's like, I think even the reader has this idea of like Annie's this big tough lady when a man is literally like in a wheelchair in front of her, like can't move his legs. But like, oh, it's a police officer. Like, she'll, like, what's she gonna do? But like, then she gets on the riding mower and just destroys this cop. And it is like this, you want her to keep going. Like, you know, when at the very end, when she seems maybe unkillable, like she's not in the room that Paul thought she died in. And like you do think, you're like, yeah, I don't know if she can be killed. I don't know if this, if she is a person or just like a creature of like darkness. And it's really great. Oh, I was thinking about another aspect of like talking about this, like how it is in some ways like this fantasy. And I think it ties to like, again, the idea of like this is like such a maternal villain. Like this is like she embodies these things about like femininity and like this, and I think that it is, it's something that is just sort of like unremarked on, but like it is like when he's in this productivity, like he's going at it, she's feeding him, she's, you know, and the whole time she is a nurse, she is nursing him, she's caring for him. And it's like I think that's fascinating as well, where it's like he's like, oh, I'm so productive right now. Like, you know, I'm not drinking, I'm not smoking. Also, all your material needs are being met. And that's just very interesting. Like, I think it's often talked about the way that these like men in history, especially writers, will like be credited for all this productivity. I wonder if this is the case for Stephen King. You know, he has this great productivity. Who's cleaning his house? Who's making his meals? Like, I have to think that there's some, you know, invisible labor going on there. I think it's so fascinating, this idea of like he hates her but needs her at every moment of this story, and like she has made it that way, and I think she revels in that.
And that he could not, have his finest work if it hadn't been for her. And yet I love that you said that about how it's sort of like caretaking, because immediately my mind was like, Thoreau was riding Walden and taking his laundry to his mother
Yeah, exactly.
immediately.
No, it's just that's history. That's like every like great man, there's someone doing his laundry and yeah, making his breakfast every morning.
And Annie has this wonderful backstory. She is a nurse. She is this angel of death. I love the breadcrumbing of her backstory of every once in a while she'll go like, they put me on the stand in Boulder, and that's all you get. And it keeps going. I mean, the progression is fantastic. And I think the dialogue is so sharp. I think a hallmark of a really great writer is, they said this in film school of like when you can cover up the names on a script and still tell who's saying what. Annie, for all her villainy, doesn't like curse words, is very, PG. She's always using the word cockadoodie. And I found like that it's a, a hallmark of a really good writer. I would find myself like I would drop something and I'd be like, oh, jeepers, which I don't think she ever says. But like,
No, but it's
it
in
gets
that
in you.
vein. Yeah, no, and I love that. I love that aspect of it, that it is like, I think it's such a good commentary. And yeah, the 80s, you know, it's like the Reagan era, like yuppie era respectability. And it's like this idea that like, no, like you can be an absolutely evil, evil person and be offended by profanity. Like, and that is like, yeah, that's like the moral majority. What we're seeing now with this like Christian nationalism, where it's like, no, you can be an absolutely empathyless, vile human being and be like, oh, we don't use the Lord's name in vain here. And I think that's just like a great villain and still feels subversive in a way to have this person who's like more offended about the words she's hearing than like the actions she's doing. And she still has the moral high ground in her mind, even, you know, nothing she does will seem it's her internal psychology, like, follows these kind of rules that the book
Yeah.
talks about, where it's like a character has to be structurally sound, and like it is, like everything she does and like her backstory and the way it's unfolded, it all is like, no, like this makes sense. This is a woman who follows these, she has very specific rules for her life and she follows them. And for her, that is like she's set, like she knows right and wrong from her perspective and is like unmoved from it. Great character.
Yeah, I mean, it is a wonderful book. There was one thing that I have you ever seen the Sam Neill Isabel Adjani film Possession?
I have not, no.
It's a wild horror movie. It's from early 80s, handful of years before this. But there is a scene where Isabel Adjani cuts herself with an electric knife, and Annie cuts off Paul's thumb with an electric knife, and I was just like, that it's gotta be a reference to this one random 80s movie that I've seen. But it's again, it's like it's the most mundane things, you know, if she and there's and you can certainly read an element of maternalism and domesticity in using a kitchen object if you want to read it that way. Absolutely. Oh, I love this book.
I think the ending, when he's basically he's has PTSD but also is like
Yeah.
struggling to write after, I love the way he describes, and again, this is just like Stephen King writing about writing, which is, I think, always great. Like the way that he describes getting those first like shreds of inspiration for a new story and like the hope that that brings him. I think that I have experienced that in my life of like being in this stretch of like kind of like a creative drought, and then like having that feeling of like it's almost like a new crush, you know? It's like
Yeah.
you're like, oh, another story I get to tell myself. And like, a little inspiration will strike you in that way, and I do love that it is like maybe a rare hopeful ending for Stephen King, where
Yeah.
he is moving forward as a writer, and maybe, you know, this next book, it probably won't be Fast Cars and it won't be Misery either, but it's something that's probably more true
Yeah.
to him and like more real. And yeah, it's like, what is it? He sees like a boy with a raccoon, I think.
Yeah, I think
And it's like
yeah.
that even that, like you were saying, how Fast Cars, it's like macho, it's cars, it's manly. And like this is like a boy and a creature. Like there's just
Yeah.
something gentler about that. And yeah, I just love, I do think about that a lot when I'm starting to get like a creative idea. I think I remember the way that he describes it, where it's like you're finding this hope and you're like sort of beginning to see something, and like hopefully you can like, you know, find the hole in the page
Yeah.
and dive in. I love that description of getting into a flow for writing.
Yeah, it is a rewarding experience to start writing and then it's an hour later and you didn't notice the time go by. It is it's wonderful that this is a book about writing and for writing that is actually rewarding for everyone to read. You know, everyone can love this book. I think that's a really hard and rare needle to thread.
I think that this was one of the first books that, like, when I finished it, I was like, I want to hear what other people have to say about this. Like, and that was like, I think one of the first times I like went on the internet looking for like book reviews, because I was like, I have a lot of opinions about this book. I have a lot of feelings about it, and I want to know if other people do. And like, I was also, you know, very self-consciously as a kid, like wanting to like think of myself as like an intellectual, as like a good reader. I'm reading adult books. Like, and so I was just like, I think one of the first, I'm just forming my opinions and
Yeah.
being like, wait, I want to see like if these opinions are similar to like the consensus. And I think I read some like really great reviews where they talked about like the way that this is a book about writing. And I think I definitely just like have taken messages from this book, like
Yeah.
forward as a writer myself.
Absolutely. Well, I guess it's time then for the final question. Would you consider this required reading?
I mean, I think that's been this whole podcast. We just go back and forth.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's so good. Like,
Read
I really, yeah, I
this
do think that, especially if you're someone who doesn't like to read like self-help books or like nonfiction, like I, because I hate any book that's like telling me what to do. But like, I think that this book is great in sort of, it's a thriller, it's horror, but it also like tricks you into learning about the creative process. So I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah. If you can't read The Artist's Way, maybe try this.
Yeah, this will probably take you less than 12 months
Oh
or
my gosh.
however long. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, of
Is there
course.
anything you'd like to plug? Of course, your show on the 15th of November.
Yes, yeah, that would be my big thing. Only thing I'll be plugging right now is Elysian Spaghetti Fest, November 15th at 5 p.m. I show Transcribe, a solo show. It's going to be stand up, some storytelling, some character stuff. There might even be a song in there. So yeah, I'm really excited. It's going to be part of the idea of the Spaghetti Fest is for new works. They like ask you like, what's your big creative swing? And so this is definitely like a big new venture for me, so I'm really excited about it. So hope some of y'all can check it out.
My gosh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I'm gonna turn off the recording if that feels
Amazing.
good.
Yeah. Thank you.